Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Among all the people of Montana, seven are charged with the sober responsibility to interpret and uphold our state's constitution. They are the justices of the Montana Supreme Court. This year there is a contested election for a seat on the court. Kristen Juris, attorney and adjunct professor at the University of Montana Law School, is one of the two candidates. Professor Juris, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you for inviting me, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in Conrad, Montana, which is north of Great Falls on the High Line. I'm a fourth-generation Montanan from agricultural families on both sides. My mom and dad, Pat and Rib Gustafson, had a ranch in the Conrad area, which my family still operates today. And my father was also a veterinarian, a cowboy, a storyteller. Both of them served on the local school board, were both very involved in their community.
And if I was to ask you key values that you learned from your folks or from the community growing up before you went away to college, what would that be?
Number one was hard work. Our father especially ingrained in each of us children a very hard work ethic. A typical day for me is I get up by 6:30 in the morning and I work until I lay my head down at 9:30 when I usually pause and read. My mother was very other-oriented, very compassionate, very nurturing, and so that was a trait that I believe I gained from her influence.
I've looked carefully at your website, which is extensive and impressively diverse. And I have some questions about it. You make the point that your diversity of background you feel is an important qualification for serving on the court. Why?
The law has become as specialized as medicine. I would bring to the court an area of expertise that I believe is currently lacking on the court, and that is 34 years of experience representing farmers, ranchers, small business owners, nonprofit organizations, individuals, in the daily legal issues that they face. I have also taught at the law school since 2000 in the areas of property law, business law, tax law, international law, agricultural law. For example, I would be the only justice who has not only opened a headgate and irrigated a hayfield, but has filed and defended water rights claims. And I believe that the area of water rights law is an important area for our state and our number one industry, agriculture. And we've only seen the tip of the iceberg in water rights litigation. Only 6 of our 85 basins have been adjudicated. So more and more of those cases will be coming up.
I think implicit in the statement that that matters and that's lacking on the court is the implication that one's life experience as a judge can influence one's interpretation of the law, fair or unfair.
That is fair.
I think many of us as citizens might say, wait a minute, the law is the law. Like Chief Justice Roberts says, you're calling balls and strikes, that's his phrase. And that one's life and the values that one obtains from life should be irrelevant. What's your thought?
I believe that justice's role is more than calling balls and strikes. I certainly think there's some of that going on. But when parties bring complicated legal issues to the court, to the extent that justices have practiced in that area, have been on both sides of the fence, have previously researched, problem solved in these areas, I believe that that brings an experience that benefits the particular interpretation or application of the law in that particular case. I do think it's very important on the court that we have a variety of expertise. It is very beneficial to have justices who have prosecuted crimes, who have defended crimes, justices who have been a district court judge, and of course we do have a former district court judge, Justice McKinnon, and a former administrative law judge, Jim Shea. They have much more experience in procedural and evidentiary issues. And that diversity of experience makes the court better as a whole than its single parts. The justices deliberate, they can share backgrounds, they can share experiences to come to a better result.
I appreciate the emphasis on the benefit of diversity of human, I'll call it diversity of human and professional experience. People also from life develop different value priorities, which Justice Wheat on this show, when I interviewed him when he was running last time, said made a difference to him, his personal values drawn from life. You listed some at the beginning of the program that you took from your family. You've developed others over time. Do justices' philosophical values have an appropriate role on the court? Do they make a difference in decisions?
I don't think anybody can deny that a justice's values and philosophical background is a filter through which justices may view particular problems. But I don't agree that those values and that philosophical background should be the sole determinative factor of reaching a conclusion. So let me give you an example. My mom and dad, like all marriages, struggled. They had many good days, but some difficult times. But they were committed to marriage. And I'm so grateful that I was one of fewer and fewer people who, you know, were able to get together with both of my parents at all of the big events in my family's lives. So I'm committed to marriage and to family. Nonetheless, I will apply the divorce laws as they have been adopted and written by the legislature. And that is what needs to drive the outcome, is what those particular laws are, not my commitment to marriage.
Okay, the divorce laws, in what particular respect? Are you speaking about rights of custody? Are you speaking about property? Are you speaking about gay marriage? What are we talking about?
Divorce laws in general. For example, Montana is one of a vast majority of states who has a no-fault divorce law that makes it very easy for either party to step away from the marriage, and then the laws apply to determine custody and to determine property resolutions. Personally, philosophically, I wish it were more difficult to obtain a divorce, but that is not what our legislation requires. And so my philosophical or values with regard to marriage really have no role in applying the divorce laws of our state as written by our legislature.
What would you say about the legislative actions related to gay marriage?
In 2015, the United States Supreme Court determined that there is a fundamental right to same-sex marriage. That is the law of the land. I do believe that the legislatures need to consider debate in the public forum areas, legislation that will address when that fundamental right to same-sex marriage may conflict with other fundamental rights, including the fundamental right to the exercise of your religious beliefs. So I believe that the legislature should consider, for example, to what extent are churches who offer their property for public events going to be required to also provide their facilities for same-sex marriages.
Even if they disagree with same-sex marriage on a doctrinal basis.
That's correct. So the legislature does have room to, they should be looking at some of those conflicts. And if they don't, the courts are going to be addressing some of those conflicts as they arise. In other states around the country, some of those conflicts have already arisen.
I think labels oversimplify but often give some sort of hint of general valid direction. If you were to summarize your values, your political philosophy, how would you describe it, as it might affect your filter, as you called it, and I think, frankly, appropriately called it?
My political philosophies are, for example, fiscal frugality. I'm grateful that we're one of the states that has a constitutional requirement for a balanced budget. My political philosophy is that if the marketplace can fill a service, they most likely, not always, but often will be a better provider of that service than the government. I have done a lot of work in taxation issues. I believe in a fair and equitable tax base. And of course, we could have a 3-hour interview on what that might consist of. So those are some of my political philosophical viewpoints.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are interviewing candidate for the Montana Supreme Court, professor of the University of Montana School of Law, Kristen Juris. Pursuing the discussion of philosophical values, you include that you served as the faculty advisor of the Christian Legal Society. I assume, therefore, you're a Christian.
I am.
Okay. In terms of controversy over time, the span of the Constitution since 1789, including the writing of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights subsequently, it's been a controversial issue, the separation of church and state and the commingling of church and state. Do you have any observations to make about that as a lawyer, first of all?
One law review article that I had begun but did not complete because of time constraints was a study of Supreme Court decisions from, you know, the early 1800s through today and their references to not only Christian but other religious beliefs. And in the early part of our history, opinions commonly referred to biblical phrases or other religious phrases. And in the 1950s, 1960s, you did see a marked pulling back from religious references in U.S. Supreme Court decisions. And I agree that there are two clauses in the First Amendment. Clearly, the government cannot establish a religion. My family came from Sweden, where the Swedish government dictated that you were a member of the Lutheran Church, and they told you which church you were to belong to. In other countries, they, including today in Germany, they assess a tax on all citizens that are given to a parish that citizen lives within. And clearly, the U.S. government is prohibited from establishing any religion. The second one is that nor can the government prohibit the free exercise. So they are to not establish a religion. It seems to me that they clearly intended that it's the citizens themselves who have the ability to decide what faith, if any, that they will follow without any government interference, and that they can live out those faiths in their daily lives.
Okay, it gets sticky is the right to a qualified right to an abortion, for example, and a doctor's right not to perform that abortion for religious reasons, or a pharmacist's right, quote unquote, not to give a morning after pill. How does your philosophy affect your views on those issues?
Those are the sorts of conflicts that the court has been more increasingly addressing and will continue to address.
Yep.
That is going to be an area where I think we'll be seeing more and more refinement, more and more decisions coming out addressing the free exercise. And how far does that reach? Some people take the position that you're only free to exercise your faith in worship within a church itself. But I believe that the majority of opinions today would not limit your free exercise to what you do within a church, but that it does affect your life.
You just, for example, pointed out that the Supreme Court has ruled gay marriage is a fundamental right. And the infringement on that right, from my recollection of law school, requires strict scrutiny of the court for state action that infringes on that right, strict scrutiny of the law, and there are certain steps you take in applying strict scrutiny. Does it fill the purpose? Is it narrow in scope? And I can't remember off the top. The
compelling state interest.
That's right, a compelling state interest. So do you have an opinion on, let's say, restrictions that legislatures might pass on the fundamental right of gay marriage or the right of businesses to, let's say, I'm sorry, I don't serve gay people in this restaurant, the right of private enterprise, broadly speaking?
I believe that after the Obergefell decision that, for example, the Montana constitutional amendment that limited marriage to a man and a woman is not enforceable, that the state is not able to prohibit gay marriages. But some issues that we're going to see, it's larger than gay marriage. For example, there's already been a polygamy lawsuit filed saying that under the Obergefell decision that now that there is a right to polygamous marriages. So to what extent does the Obergefell decision, and the U.S. Supreme Court didn't fully address this, limit the ability of the state to regulate marriage at all. And states historically have regulated marriages in many ways, including how close of a relationship you can have. And just, by the way, in Montana, that's second cousins. And what age you can be before you can be married, how many spouses you can have. So we're going to be facing those issues. But then the other areas are, to what extent, for example, can a cake baker, because of a genuinely held religious belief, decline to provide services? And that's areas where the legislature should be considering.
What is your view on that particular issue? It reminds me, frankly, I'm 69 years old, of desegregation in a restaurant, saying the federal law may say blacks can eat in my restaurant, but I ain't serving them.
You have two fundamental rights. You have a fundamental right to marriage, and you have a fundamental right to freely exercise your religious faith.
Okay.
And when those two rights come into conflict, which I believe they will, it is going to be a case-by-case analysis based on the specific facts that come before the court. Now, let me give a few other examples. There is also a fundamental right to be free of discrimination from your gender. However, the courts have consistently upheld, for example, the right of the Catholic Church in exercising a genuinely held belief not to hire women as priests.
Right.
You have a right to be free from discrimination because of your religious beliefs. But courts have consistently held that, for example, a Baptist church is not required to hire a Buddhist as a pastor as a free exercise of the genuine beliefs. So there is not a simple answer to this. They're both serious fundamental rights. I believe it's best resolved and should start in the legislative process, where you have full public debate, full public participation as to the establishment of an initial set of parameters, and that it should only go to the court if the legislature fails to act, or perhaps legislation will be challenged as having gone too far or having not gone far enough.
That's almost a safe bet in some of these issues, obviously. You've emphasized, I think, quite eloquently the difference between the legislative role and the court's role. We now have a situation where we're getting elections for courts more and more. That involves campaigning and what I would call broadly politics. And I'd like to get your opinion on the question of electing judges. Former Supreme Court Justice Carla Gray, as you know, is not a fan. She's been on our show talking about an appointive system followed by what I'll call validation elections if the justice meets the public approval after some time of performance. What is your view about the election of judges? Good idea, bad idea, and why?
I believe that justices should be elected under Montana's form of government. I'd like to read Article 2, Section 1, which is our Declaration of Rights. All political power is vested in and derived from the people. All government of right originates with the people. Section 2, the people have the exclusive right of governing themselves. When people are not allowed to elect justices, they are limited in their participation of electing a very important government official.
All right.
I believe that there are pros and cons from both the elective side and the appointive side. Federal justices and judges are appointed, and
yes,
I don't think anyone would say that that is free of problems.
Do you advocate election to the United States Supreme Court?
I wouldn't be opposed to the election of federal judges, because I believe that the more power you give the people to be involved in the elective process, the more self-government rights they have.
One of the realities of elections is they involve money.
Unfortunately.
And money is often seen by the public and probably many historians. I'm thinking of Montana's own history in that respect. Money can buy influence or decisions. So the concern of some people is that electing judges involves them in soliciting funds, out-of-state funds. The last judicial election for the Supreme Court involved a lot of out-of-state money, written up publicly nationally. It was a targeted state. What's your sense about the issue of money and running for an impartial position? You're by definition supposed to be impartial. money typically has strings. Your thoughts?
I'd like to make two comments. And the first, let's start with direct contributions by individuals, because in Montana, corporations can't contribute to a judicial campaign. The United States Supreme Court has upheld limits on those direct contributions, rightfully so, because the limit for Montana Supreme Court justices is $990 per donor to each candidate. Then the second issue is indirect expenditures over which a candidate has no control. In the 2014 election, a Billings law firm contributed over $60,000 to a political action committee that it had formed to support one of the two candidates. I believe that a $60,000 contribution is influential, and that any justice who receives that amount of money should always recuse himself or herself when those particular attorneys have a case before the justice.
We did a show about, I think it was Virginia or in North Carolina, I might have the states wrong, coal mining case. The executive involved, the coal mine is now in prison for a separate issue. $3.2 million he contributed through various means to support a justice to that was going to rule on his case, and then it was a swing vote, 3-2 or 4-3. Supreme Court of the United States overturned that decision, said the justice should have recused himself, but it overturned it on a 5-4 decision, which was astonishing to me.
I think that a $3.2 million contribution, if that can be established, a justice should recuse himself or herself. I want to make a comment. In the 1972 Constitutional Convention, one of the most widely debated topics was whether justices should be elected or appointed. And as you know, right now we have a hybrid situation because justices are appointed if a justice steps down in the middle of the term. But they also debated the public financing of judicial elections for this very reason that you're discussing. And the constitutional delegates decided not to make that a part of the Constitution after they debated it at some length. I personally would like that. I would like to see judicial candidates have some sort of public financing, but then where do you draw the line? If judicial candidates, why not other legislative candidates? So that was discussed, and the Constitutional Convention decided not to go with it.
I think you make an important distinction in terms of legislature, the role of legislators and judges, and appreciate the point. You're listening to Home Ground, and I am Brian Kahn. We are interviewing Kristen Juris, adjunct professor of law at the University of Montana School of Law. I'd like to discuss with you some sort of broad concepts. One is takings. Fifth Amendment, government shall not take private property without just compensation, words to that effect. You have experience as a property law professor. A couple of cases come to mind. One was an elk farm decision that prohibited the raising of elk as a commercial venture in the state of Montana. And then there was a case that someone called the Bridges of Madison County, of establishing public access to rivers around bridge right-of-ways. Comments on the broad area? Any comments on those cases that you'd like to make?
It's an area of law that is of great interest to me. When, under what circumstances, for what purposes can the government take private property? And no one would dispute that you can condemn property for a public highway, for a school. In the Elk case, which was the Kafka case, the issue was more complicated. The state had promoted elk farms and granted licenses to individuals who went through an application process and satisfied all of the conditions to raise elk. By an initiative, the public decided that the raising of private elk was not good for Montana. The question then became, and those elk license holders could no longer do most of their activities with elk, so the value of their business plummeted. Mm-hmm. And they asserted that the government had taken their property. And the Montana Supreme Court, in a split decision, ruled that this was a license, and when you receive licenses from the government, it's not a form of property that is assured to last forever. It's subject to regulation, and they found that it was not a taking for the government to have further regulated a license which it was the government who originally
Did you agree
issued.
With the decision?
No, I probably would have joined the dissent on okay. that one, joined with, and Justice Nelson wrote a very interesting dissent in that case. The right. Bridges of Madison County involved a different issue. One of the issues was that under the 1985 Montana Stream Access Law, which is settled law, you can walk up a stream bed, float up a stream bed, use the stream bed as necessary to recreate. And if there's an artificial barrier in the water, you can also portage up onto the riparian property owner's land. And the question was, did that create an easement on private property that was mm-hmm. a taking that should have been compensated? The U.S. Supreme Court in a case in California had determined several years ago that granting an easement for access to the ocean in that case across private property was in fact a taking. However, the Montana Supreme Court determined that portaging on private property above an artificial barrier was not a taking that merited compensation.
And what would your view have been on that case?
I would have followed the U.S. Supreme Court precedents that if you grant an easement across private property, that is a taking that does have to be compensated. But another issue in that case was whether you can access a stream from a public bridge.
Right.
And the court concluded yes, and there are some more complicated issues. But I agree with that you can access a river through any public access site, including a public bridge.
Another hot issue is the right to keep and bear arms nationally and in Montana. Montana's constitution has a specific provision. There are some people who are taking the position that the right to carry a concealed weapon is a constitutional right. What is your view?
The Montana Constitution, Article 2, Section 2, specifically states that the right to keep or bear arms shall not be called into question, but that it shall not be held to permit the carrying of concealed weapons. So that is clear under the Montana Constitution that regulation of concealed weapons is permissible. Some people may suggest that doesn't meet muster with the United States Constitution, that the United States Constitution may not allow regulation of concealed weapons, but the federal courts have taken a different stance and do allow certain regulations of arms, including concealed weapon carries.
You've studied law, you've practiced law, you've taught law. Why do you want to serve on the Supreme Court?
Because I think all three of those aspects of my experience will make me a good justice. That my time at the law school was particularly helpful in research, being able to break down a statute into its elements and apply it, clear and concise explanations. That is the role of an appellate judge.
Why does that matter to you?
I want our Montana Supreme Court to be the very best court that it can be, and I believe that bringing the diversity of experience that I offer would make it a better court.
Kristen Juris, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Thank you.